Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight I have the distinct privilege of introducing our speaker, Christopher Caldwell. Christopher Caldwell is a senior fellow and contributing editor of the Claremont Review of Books. He is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. He is the author of Reflections on the Revolution in Europe, Immigration, Islam, and the West, an acclaimed study of the impact of the mass immigration of Muslim immigrants to Europe in the 20th century. His newest book, The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s, which he will be discussing tonight, is a brilliant and ambitious account of how the reforms of the past 50 years left the country with two incompatible political systems and drove it towards conflict. Please join me in welcoming Christopher Caldwell.
That's very nice. All right, so I've been asked here this evening to explain how American society has come to be divided by party and by ideology in a way that it maybe has not been since the Civil War. I've just published a book, As It Happens, that I hope answers that question. Tess has described it. Thank you very much, Tess. Thank you, David. Thank you, Matt Spaulding, and everyone at Hillsdale for having me here. The book runs basically from the assassination of John F. Kennedy to the election of Donald J. Trump. I think you can get a good idea of the drift of the narrative. I say narrative more than argument. You get a good idea of the drift of the narrative from the titles of its eight chapters. And they are 1963, race, sex, war, debt, diversity, winners, and losers. I can end part of the suspense right now as we talk about parties, which is the Democrats are the winners. The Democrats are the party of the people who won the conflict of the 1960s. They gained money, power, and prestige. Republicans, in general, are the party of the people who lost those conflicts. Now, in my book, this argument has a number of strands, which I hope come together in a useful or at least a coherent way. One strand involves the Vietnam War. Vietnam played a very strange part in leaving behind a lot of distortions in American life. One thing I focus on, there are many aspects of the war and the protests against it that I focus on, but the way the army was mustered wound up contributing to a class system. And what I'm talking about here primarily is the student deferment. In the old days, university-level specialist expertise was rare, and it made sense to keep those who had it out of harm's way. So, for instance, at the start of World War I, only about 1 in 30 American men was in university. When you got into Vietnam, about 1 in 2 American men were in university, and we still had this deferment. So if you were rich enough to study art history, you basically went to Woodstock and you made love, you know? If you were not rich enough, when you worked in a garage, you went to Da Nang and you made war. Losing the war turned this class problem that we had into something very serious, because it allowed when we lost the war, it allowed the rich, or the richer Americans, the better off Americans, who disproportionately did not participate, to mistake the class division for a moral division. The rich saw themselves, or the better off saw themselves, as having avoided service in Vietnam, not because they were more privileged or less brave or anything like that, but because they were more decent or more far-seeing. And I think that was corrosive. One strand of the story involved women. Today, there are two cultures of American womanhood. There's a culture of married women and a culture of single women. If you poll them on political issues, they'll come up diametrically opposed on most of them. It's tough to think of two groups that differ more. During the Kennedy administration, polls showed that there was something like a unified culture of American womanhood. And it united women from cradle to grave. If you asked questions of married and unmarried women, they'd answer them exactly the same. So 90% of married women and 87% of unmarried women believed there was such a thing as women's intuition. 16% of married women and 15% of unmarried women thought it was okay under certain highly defined circumstances to have an affair outside of marriage. But 99% of women of all ages believe that the optimal age for marriage was under 27. And there were next to no responses for never to that question. But there is one strand of the argument in my book that runs from beginning to end, and that's certainly the most important as far as party is concerned. And that concerns how the civil rights laws of the 1960s, and particularly the Civil Rights Act of 1964, divided the country. And they did so, I explain in the course of the book, by giving the country what was in effect a second constitution, which caused Americans to peel off into two different and incompatible constitutional cultures. This became obvious only very slowly, only over time. So slowly, I think, that people are still unable to see it in many cases. And since most of the discussion in our official culture concerns how the Civil Rights Act of 1964 brought the country together, suggesting that it might have pulled the country apart has caused my book to be met with some controversy and outrage. Now, this outrage has been particularly pronounced among one specific group of Americans that is unfortunately very large, although I hope it will fall, and I mean those who have not read my book, okay? So for their benefit, including any who might be inclined to review it, I should really make crystal clear, okay, that this book is not a defense of segregation or Jim Crow, and that when I criticize civil rights, I am not criticizing the impulse to equality in general, and I am not criticizing the movement for black equality in particular. What I am talking about is the system, is the set of mechanisms that, in the name of ending segregation, were established and given to Washington as tools. These gave Washington the authority to override what Americans had traditionally thought of as their ordinary democratic institutions. They were widely understood by the public as temporary and local. Whether that expectation was justified or not is another question. But they soon escaped democratic control altogether, and they have now become the most powerful part of our governing system. So let's talk about how that worked. I think that there were two noteworthy things about the civil rights legislation of 1964 and 1965. First, as I said, was its unprecedented concentration in power. It gave Washington tools that it had never had in peacetime. It created new crimes involving discrimination in many walks of public and private life. It revoked, if you wanted to put it strongly, you could say repealed, the prevailing understanding of freedom of association that was implicit in the First Amendment. It established new agencies to hunt down those crimes. So it expanded the Civil Rights Commission. It established an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. It set up various offices of civil rights in the different cabinet agencies that could lay out guidelines that had the force of law. It gave government new prerogatives, like laying out hiring practices for all companies with more than 15 employees, filing certain lawsuits, conducting investigations, ordering redress. I mean, to put it as bluntly as I do in the book, the effect of these laws was to take a lot of decisions that had been made in the democracy and relocate them either in the bureaucracy or in the judiciary. Okay? And so only with that kind of arsenal, Lyndon Johnson and the drafters of civil rights legislation thought, would it be possible to root out insidious racism. Okay? The second thing about these acts were they were slightly a fudge. As I say, they sat uneasily with parts of the Constitution, not just the First Amendment. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, passed largely to vindicate the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal citizenship, did so by creating different rights for citizens regarding election laws, depending on whether you lived in Alabama, or, for instance, or whether you lived in Michigan. But really, no one worried about such things so much. As long as it was about segregation, they were willing to let it go. The goal of civil rights law was to short-circuit the sham democracies of the American South and to bring them into conformity with the Constitution. But nobody's democracy is perfect, and it turned out to be harder to distinguish between the South's democracy and everyone else's. So if the spirit of the law was to humiliate Southern bigots and overturn Southern segregation, the letter of the law put the entire country and all of its institutions under threats of lawsuits and prosecutions for discrimination. But as I say, people were not too worried about that. It's clear in retrospect that outside of the South, most Americans understood segregation as a regional problem. As far as we can measure in the polls, you know, 70, 80, 90% of people in the Northeast, in the Midwest, if you asked them whether black people were treated fairly in their neighborhoods and their part of the country, would say yes, they were treated fine, just the same as whites. In practice, they did not expect these new laws to be turned back on them. The problem is that when the work of civil rights legislation was done, when de jure segregation was stopped, these powers were not stopped or scaled down or reassessed. On the contrary, they intensified. The ability to set quotas was not in the original legislation, but offices of civil rights in the education, in HEW, started doing that. And there was no one really strong enough to object. Busing of school children was not in this original legislation. But once you had these goals and guidelines for integration in schools, judges started ordering it. So you had many things happening. Affirmative action is another one. That was a vague notion in the civil rights bill. But by the time of the Bakke case in 1978, it had become an outright system of racial preferences. And for those of you too young to remember that case, it involved a plaintiff, he was not the plaintiff, I believe, Alan Bakke, who had been a Marine captain in Vietnam, was rejected in his application for medical school at the University of California, Davis, despite having test scores that were in the 96th, 94th, 97th, and 72nd percentiles, while minority applicants in a special program were admitted with scores that were on average in the 34th, 30th, 37th, and 18th. So although the court decided that Bakke deserved to be admitted, it did not do away with affirmative action. In fact, it institutionalized it as it was done in the name of diversity, which was a new concept at the time. But another thing was happening, and that is that other groups many of them not even imagined in the first civil rights law, got the hang of using civil rights law. So immigrant advocates, for instance, no one ever voted for bilingual education, but the Supreme Court okayed it in 1974, and rule writers at the Office of Civil Rights in HEW established it, and it exists today. Women as well. The EEOC spent much of the 80s sort of debating the family leave policy at Sears Roebuck. And so finally, when you got into the 80s, civil rights came to dominate and even overrule legislation that had seemingly nothing to do with it. And I think the most traumatic example and lasting example for the country was the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. I think this is an interesting case. It can be compared to certain Supreme Court cases in the sort of like the decades of, I'm thinking of like Roe v. Wade, in the decades of political strife that it left in its wake. Now, IRCA, as the bill was called, was supposed to be the grand compromise on which our 21st century immigration policy would be built. On the one hand, about 3 million illegal immigrants had come in from Mexico and other parts of Latin America, primarily. And they were to be given citizenship under IRCA. But to keep that from incentivizing further immigration, there were really draconian laws put in place to ensure that immigration would never get out of control that way again. And so what you had was very harsh penalties called employer sanctions on any employer who hired an illegal immigrant. So the law passed, and what happened? Well, the amnesty was for real. It went into effect immediately. But the penalties turned out to be, the employer sanctions turned out to be not workable, because for an employer to ask an employee who, let's say, looked Mexican, whether he was born in Mexico or what his citizen was, turned out to violate his civil rights. So in this case, and in others, civil rights law made it impossible for people to get the things they had voted for. And every law, even in areas like this, which seemed to have nothing to do with civil rights, turned into an expansion of this civil rights law. And if we had time, we could look at sort of further developments in later decades. Now, basically, more and more areas of American life were withdrawn from voters' democratic control and subjected to the bureaucratic, judicial, emergency powers of civil rights law. And here is where I say that civil rights law had become a second constitution with powers that could be used to override the first. And so now we're at the heart of how the parties have tended to come apart. Let's talk about the Constitution that resulted, okay? I don't mean that it has become the Constitution, but it has certain constitutional aspects. And I'd like to talk about two of these aspects. First, this new civil rights Constitution has a moral element, almost a metaphysical element, that is usually more typical of theocracies than of secular republics. It takes a little bit of explaining. As we've said, civil rights law gave emergency powers to override the normal democratic constitutional order. But I think the key question when it comes to such powers is, under what circumstances can government activate these emergency powers? And this is kind of an edgy area of European political philosophy. But I think it's a very different question over there, because in Europe, where you've had problems with governments bypassing their usual constitution by means of states' emergencies, it's usually on the grounds of a military or security threat or a threat to public order. The American regime increasingly did this for moral emergencies. So America can't wait. There are people who are suffering. Their rights are being violated. We got to do this now. Every day that a gay person lives without being able to be married, there's suffering going on, and we can't mess around and wait for the ordinary democratic process to take its toll. Now, a moral grounds for invoking an emergency sounds much nicer, but actually, in fact, it can be kind of pernicious, because it requires that the government, in order to act, create a class of officially designated malefactors. In the original civil rights legislation of 1964, the justification of this strong medicine was that you had a collection of Southern politicians who were so clever and devious, and a collection of Southern sheriffs who were so ruthless and depraved, that one could not, and one was not morally obliged to, you know, fight them along according to Marcus of Queensbury rules. And I must say that pattern holds even as the focus of this sort of law has shifted. Every intervention in the name of rights requires the identification of a malefactor. So very on in the gay marriage debate, those who believed in traditional marriage were likened to segregationists or to those who had opposed interracial marriage. Earlier this week, Joe Biden, the presidential candidate, said, "Let's be clear, transgender equality is the civil rights issue of our time. There is no room for compromise when it comes to basic human rights." Now, reading that through the lens of the laws that we have in the country since the 1960s, I take that to mean that although Joe Biden and the rest of us may still be getting to just learning about transgender business and everything, I doubt Joe Biden is really expert about it, we're not going to be able to sort of like grope our way to an understanding of it either through the ballot box or through our legislatures. This is going to be decreed. We're going to be told by a judge or someone just what our policy towards transgenderism is going to be. So I'm saying that as these laws were extended into broader areas of American life, this imputation of moral non-personhood was aimed at a growing number of people who had really committed no sin more grievous than just sort of believing the same things that they had believed 5 years ago. So that's the first thing, I think, the moral aspect of these laws. The second thing is more of a sociological point, and it has to do with what progressive activists call intersectionality. As long as civil rights was limited to Southern blacks and to ending segregation, it was a stable system. It was not a sort of like a moving part, because it had the logic of history behind it, which both justified it and focused it, that is, limited it. But if other groups could be given the privilege of advancing their rights by bureaucratic fiat and judicial decree, then things got kind of interesting in terms of electoral politics, because then there was the possibility that you might gradually build up vast new coalitions and maybe even electoral majorities, because almost everyone who was not a white heterosexual male could benefit from civil rights law in some way, okay? And this brings us to a sensitive problem which you will understand a little better if you followed the constitutional politics of India. India had the first modern minority rights-based constitution. It had a long enumerated list of so-called scheduled tribes and castes. And that's what India's politics has been about for much of the time since the late 40s. Eventually, negotiations between minorities and the state took up so much of Indian government's energy that there emerged as a kind of a photographic negative, a group of Indians who were not covered in these vast number of scheduled tribes and classes, and just sort of began to grumble that, you know, they're everyone except the people on that list. And they are a big part of the movement behind the present Prime Minister Narendra Modi's coalition. So if you like Modi, you say that he's the candidate of ordinary middle-class Indians. If you don't like him, as most of the international media and the elite media in India do not, then you say he's a Hindu nationalist, okay? And we have a version of the same thing happening, I would say, in this country. And in retrospect, it was evident in the mid-80s when this intersectional coalition came up with the term people of color to describe itself. A lot of what I do in the book is describe shifts in language that are kind of telling, but this one is really particularly striking. Because logically, if there is such a thing as a coalition of people of color demanding that they be given more out of society, they're demanding that it be gotten from people not of color. And so, as in the same way that the Indian Constitution called forth this idea of like a generic Hindu, the new civil rights constitution created a group of non-people of color. It made white people a political reality in the United States in a way that they had never been. So while this constitution didn't disfavor whites, it favored every other group that it touched and whose interests it protected, which amounts to the same thing. And now you can see a little bit where we're going with this as we discuss parties. So overwhelming, I think, is the hegemony of this 1964 constitution over the 1788 constitution that our politics has pretty naturally sorted itself into a party of those who have been helped by the new constitutional developments and a party of those who have been harmed by it. So let's say you're a gay man in a gay marriage with two adopted children, okay? The civil rights version of your country has to appear constitutional. It's not optional. It's your whole way of life depends on it. Your entire life depends on it. How could you even consider backing a party or a politician who even questioned that or wavered on it? So quite likely, in fact, if you're in that position, your whole moral idea of yourself too depends on your relationship to this new constitution. You may have marched in gay pride parades carrying signs that say things like, stop the hate, you know? And you have an idea that people who opposed your campaign, who opposed the campaign that brought you your life, that brought you the ability to marry, that brought you your children, can only have done so for absolutely terrible reasons. You are on the side of the glorious marchers of Birmingham, and they are on the side of Bull Connor. It is quite natural that you would understand the opponents of your way of life as a party of bigots, okay? Meanwhile, across town, okay, if you are a conservative person who goes to church and your seven-year-old son is being taught about gender fluidity in first grade, and there's really no avenue for you to complain. And in fact, you don't know quite what the laws are because you're not like a law professor, but you have a vague sense that if you complain to the principal, you might like lose your job or something or get ostracized in your community. Meanwhile, you're getting called an enemy of civil rights, but you kind of sense that what's going wrong in your kids' schools and the reason you can't bring them up the way you want to has got something to do with gay marriage. And then you look up and you say, sorry, I voted for this when? And to him, the other party is a party of totalitarians. And that is our system, okay? You have the party of the bigots and the party of the totalitarians, okay? And it doesn't, when you look at it that way, and I think that a lot of members of these parties do look at it that way, it is really tough to see where our common ground is going to be found in the coming years. I would say that if either of these constitutions was totally devoid of merit, we wouldn't have a problem. I mean, we could just be confident that the wiser of the two would win out by attrition in the end. The problem is that each of the constitutions, and you must remember that the 1964 Constitution is now well over half a century old, each of our two constitutions has, for its adherence, a great deal that is worth fighting over and defending to the bitter end. And unfortunately, each constitution seems to be defending itself against the others. And so, when gay marriage was being advanced 20 years ago, I mean, one of the common morale-boosting sayings of the activists was, hey, the sky didn't fall. So people would say, hey, look, we've had gay marriage in Massachusetts for 3 months now, and I got news for you right-wingers, the sky didn't fall, I think that, and they were right in what they said, but I think that they forgot how delicate a system a democratic constitutional republic is, and how difficult it is to get the formula right, and how hard it is to see when a government begins slowly, very slowly, to veer off course in a way that can take decades to become evident until one day we discover that although we say that the sky is not falling, we're saying it with a lot less conviction than we used to. Thank you very much.
So if you want to raise your hands for questions, Claire, this gentleman here. What exactly would the sky falling look like? I mean, I get the point, but from the standpoint of the left, they won. And it's our job to fade into the woodwork or the cemetery or something. Why would they not mind that?
Well, I think that in the actual context of the battles over gay marriage in Massachusetts, I think that they were referring to, the warnings that there would be a breakdown in, social, the sort of like social mores and norms and that kind of thing. And that indeed did not happen. So my point in raising it was only to say that I believe that people have different time horizons. I just think that they're the two sides in that case, as in our case, we're kind of talking past each other.
Gentlemen, all the way in the back.
So it seems to me that the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, were passed under the sort of legislative enactment from the 13th and 14th Amendment. And I think on some level, everybody here would agree that that was necessary. The Civil Rights Act, as you pointed out, when focused on segregation in the South, was necessary and justified. The problem we've come is when it has sort of creeped out into literally everything else. Do you see that, given the fact that, I think certainly any definition I would know, it was constitutional to the old Constitution, as you put it, mean, is it a legal matter? Is it the administrative structure? Is it the legal matter? Or is it just the political drift that has made this inevitable? I mean, was this inevitable, I guess, you know, given the structure of everything that came before it, is what I'm trying to say, I think.
This is something that has been nagging at me through the whole project of writing this book. And I think I know what people missed a little bit at the beginning. And I think that I'm not sure. I do not believe that people passed these laws. These laws were powerful tools. I don't think people thought of them primarily as tools. I think they were thinking primarily of segregation and stopping it. But here these tools were. The question is, why did it spread so quickly to other stuff? Why did it become the go-to governing tool? And I think the reason is, I think the Achilles heel in the legislation may have been that by giving so much power to judges and regulators, it failed to see how the two of them could have this kind of like ricocheting, sort of like pong type relationship between each other over the heads of the legislatures and the voters. And the work, there's a political scientist at Boston College named Shep Melnick, who's written absolutely extraordinary things about how a regulatory finding, you know, in an Office of Civil Rights gets turned into a constitutional precedent in a Supreme Court case, and then it becomes grounds for this same office to go into a whole new area. So that was the failure to see that was key. But I also think that they failed to see that it was the exact same people who were exercising power under civil rights type rule, who would be asked whether it was constitutionally or governmentally justified to extend that rule. So if you go to the Supreme Court and say, is it all right that judges decide what marriage is? And the judges say, sure. Do you know what I mean? So that, I think, was the Achilles heel, let's say.
This gentleman here.
Thank you for the talk. It was brilliant and bold. There's a kind of a sense of oppressor and oppressed, a Marxist template that seems to be applied before these laws kick in. And I think, you know, the Frankfurt School pushed that into the States in the 40s and 50s, and it got into the civil rights movement, which was probably apt there. But it's become now a common trope, you know, where men have oppressed women and this sort of thing. Do you feel that's been part of this problem? And if so, oh yeah.
Yes, in two ways. I will say I found very useful in studying this problem the writings of a group of mostly black academic legal theorists who wrote, mostly left wing, who wrote in the 1990s called the critical race theorists. There's one of them in who is a professor who hasn't written very much, but he's written a couple of brilliant essays on this subject, named Alan David Freeman. And he writes about the difference between the victim perspective and the perpetrator perspective. And I actually find it a very fruitful way to look at things. And it explains how you can have a discussion between two well-meaning people totally at cross purposes, okay? So in the case of segregation, you have the white perpetrators and the black victims. Now they're gonna have a very different attitude of when this is working even with the best faith in the world, if you are a black person growing up under segregation, this is a system that takes all sorts of stuff away from you, you know, the money, opportunities, job, comfort, family life, and things like that. And you're not going to feel that the injustice has been remedied until those deficits have been supplied, okay? But if you're from the perpetrator people, if you're just like, you know, let's say a journalist or a lawyer in some southern town, you don't like segregation and you think it's really bad, okay? But you think that, you know, you think that the sheriff is a jerk, you think the mayor is corrupt, you hate the way they, you know, they talk about race. But you think that as soon as people start being good, it's going to be fine. So you're fine. You don't owe anyone anything. You are behaving like a moral person. And so there's no problem as far as you're concerned. That I found. So I say that just to sort of like convey that I think this question of victim and perpetrator is a genuine one in many cases. The thing that I was trying to get to earlier is that you need to activate a moral crusade around rights. You need to designate someone as a malefactor. And I think that, you know, that's the way the law has developed.
This gentleman here.
Thank you.
Just wait for the mic, please.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Caldwell. That was impressive. I'm having a little difficulty with the premise that it seems to me you're saying that the gentleman that you refer to as saying, when did I vote for this? The premise being there that certain issues, rights issues that we're talking about here, whether it be African American rights or gay rights or LBG whatever rights, are subject to the democratic process. It seems to me this constitutional democracy makes an exception for rights from the democratic process, that rights are settled in the judiciary and not the legislatures. And so the activism of the 70s in which the left turned to the judiciary to get their way was appropriate in my thinking, except for the fact that what is a right? And it seems to me that that's where the battle is, defining what are inalienable rights and therefore what rights should be settled by the judiciary and what should be settled by the legislature. Mm-hmm. Right. Could you comment on that?
Well, I think that there are some spectacular, you know, instances of the court stepping in to, you know, declare rights in American history. But I think that before, I mean, you have had interventionist courts before, like in Dred Scott, for instance, in the 19th century. But I think that in general, before Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, which seemed to be an isolated case, the rights were what was in the Constitution. You want new rights, amend the Constitution. You know, I think that was the idea of what a right was. You couldn't just go creating rights on the say-so of a legal theory or a judicial preference. So I think that the this question of what is a right, I think, was more easily resolved and more stable than it has become.
Matt?
Thank you, Chris. It's been great talking to you on the book. And a point well taken, raising the point about the courts versus legislatures, the democratic question here. You've posed the possibility of two constitutions, the 64 Constitution and the original Constitution, implying that perhaps we might need to choose between them. I actually think we've never actually had a real choice, never actually been put to the American people. But I'm wondering whether you think that we're at the point where we can't choose anymore, it's actually too late. Number one. Number two, how then do we read the 2016 election? Is it some evidence that there might be lots of American people out there who would like to make that choice because they would like to choose a once great country? Or should we read it as the death throes of a dying republic? I'm just putting it in stark terms. You give us the choice. What's the choice? What is our choice? And what do you think the choice will be?
You know, if you don't mind, I'd like to say something about choosing in general. Because I have, you know, I opened the book by saying that people increasingly felt like they have to choose. And I should make clear that what really drove me to talk about choosing between these two constitutions is something that's in the center of the book that we didn't really touch on tonight, which is that having two constitutions, satisfying the needs of two groups who think very differently about what the country exists for, is very expensive. And I believe it's the source of our chronic deficits for the last 40 years. When I talked about choosing in the book, what I most often mean is that as it becomes more difficult or more problematic to access credit, as it did after 2008, it's tough to buy off the sides who are disappointed by one settlement or the other. Is it too late to choose? Well, I'll tell you. I mentioned a few minutes ago that, you know, this 64 Constitution has been there for almost 60 years. There are people who really depend on it. It's very interesting to see that, it clearly, not to go too far afield, okay, it clearly makes incursions on the Bill of Rights, including the First Amendment, and not just the ones on association that I'm talking earlier. I mean, the idea that the Supreme Court could rule so equivocally on a gay marriage cake case is a sign, I think, that the First Amendment is giving a bit of way to this new Constitution. So when I say that the two are in conflict, I'm not calling for people to like come back to their senses and restore our, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't see that as an immediate possibility. So what does Trump mean, which is your third question? That's a place where I conveniently end the book. But I do think it has to do, now, I've talked about the moral aspect of this legislation, which I think is really important, the moral and metaphysical aspect. You know, the United States was always a pretty live and let live kind of place. It didn't have a theme. And you hear people, you know, talking about these ideals of different rights and, you know, the right to love and all these kind of things. There's a whole set of narratives, I think, that come along with this new constitution, and they may be what endears a lot of the public to them. But there's a large number of Americans who are not protagonists in this narrative, and I think that, like a lot of cruelty, there's just a lot of people that no one's really gone out and tried to, you know, really do a bad turn to anyone who's, you know, who lives in a formerly great manufacturing town. But I think they've kind of forgotten about them, you know? And that, I think, is what Trump has to do with. I think it's the people who've been forgotten in the more recent narrative.
What's that in mind? What does that mean?
Aside from trouble? you know, what is it a sign of?
Yeah.
It's a sign of a. It's a sign of a. Of an. In, it's a sign, perhaps, of a an increasing consciousness among these people, because these trends are not new. It's a sign that they're beginning to find themselves and sort of like coalesce into a kind of a movement, perhaps.
This gentleman.
The examples that we gave around gender and stuff, they actually probably not the best one, because I think the biggest problem is that the idea of this whole movement was to create equality of opportunity, and we have moved now to create, I wouldn't even call it equality, but a certain portfolio of outcomes which have to dominate every other consideration. And the rights today, you know, today people are talking about rights of free health care, rights of housing, people are talking about a monthly income or whatever the term is used to. So the whole rights discussion has moved from rights of opportunity and the right to be left alone and not to be harmed, in the rights of you getting resources from other people to satisfy certain needs and objectives. And I think that's what the deficit is. It's about resources, not about some abstract rights of having a fair play or being let alone.
That's a subject that interests me. It's not one I deal with in my book, so I'll let your comment stand. Yeah.
Young lady.
Thank you for a very thought-provoking lecture. I have two points of confusion that you don't necessarily need to explain now. Number one, I think John Winthrop would contest your assertion that America is a live-and-let-live nation. We have a long history of moral leaders, and that is a very strong strain in our political and intellectual discourse. So that's something that's an impulse that must always be grappled with, particularly coming from New England. The second is, I'm a little confused about how the Civil Rights Act has augmented our national debt when the biggest driver of our national debt is Social Security, which was instituted prior to the Civil Rights Act. But my real question is, it seems, I actually want to build on the gentleman's comments about rights and the stability of rights. And it's hard for me to imagine that even the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments can be considered truly stable when they were bought at the cost of 600,000 American lives. That was a debate that had to be sorted in blood. So can it possibly, is a third way between these two constitutions the conception that, although not ideal, sometimes the courts and sometimes the administrative state might be a better battleground than outright civil war. So I want to see if there's any space in your argument for that consideration, that previous rights have been fought over coarser ground.
Yeah, that's an interesting theory that the fact that blood was shed to obtain the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment makes them less stable. I think some people would say it makes them more stable, but I don't know. Now, as for, you know, choosing the administrative state as a battleground, as I explain sometimes, this is really a narrative. It's a history. It's not a manifesto or a policy book, but the things I've written about and thought about lead me to believe that the problem with attempting to, if I understand you correctly, replicate some of our old democratic debates within the administrative state is that the administrative state is kind of a one-party state. So I don't think I don't think it's too promising, actually, as an avenue for productive policymaking. Now, the question of whether it beats, sort of like Civil War and things that it, which is what you seem to be implying is another question. Yeah.
We are going to adjourn. Chris will stay here to sign books, so you can be part of the growing number of people who've bought the book. Whether or not you read it will be up to you then. Thank you.